You're listening to His Time. I'm Andy Bates. It is Thursday morning. That means it is time for Historically Speaking. Joining me in studio this morning, Mark Bleasey, reference and IT, that's information technology at Concordia Historical Institute, although it could stand for something else.
I don't know, but it's not.
Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you, Andy.
Glad to have you in studio this morning. How are things going at Concordia Historical Institute?
Very busy getting ready for the convention coming up. Dr. Harmelink left this morning. That's a busy time. We do have some reference workers from out of state who are coming in. It's getting busy.
I think our GPS on Dr. Harmelink shows he's in central Illinois right about now, traveling up to Milwaukee with the gavel.
With the gavel.
It's all like protected in cushioned.
It is. Doubly protected.
Very
it's
good.
Within two cases.
Good. We don't want it to get all scratched up.
No, not at all.
Well, what do we have on doc today for Historically Speaking? Now, Dan always likes for me to say, Historically Speaking.
Historically Speaking, we're going to be talking about expansion. We've just celebrated here in our country the birth of the nation, starting from 13 colonies and then branching out to being the many states that we are today. And I thought that it would be a good thing to talk about how our own Synod expanded from starting in 1847 and then expanding beyond that. And because of the convention coming up, on how we ended up doing that, getting to the point where we're at right now, even not just within our own country, but worldwide.
How did we get to this? How did we become a synod and start growing and are expanding? And then meeting in convention regularly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Initially, when they first went ahead and started the synod, it was a yearly event.
That's what I thought.
Remember, the synod was much smaller, and so every year they would meet. But by the time they got to 1854, they decided that it was getting to be too many congregations in too large of an area. Walther couldn't visit all the different churches to go ahead and see what was going on. So they established four separate districts at that time, the Western District, the Eastern District, the Central District, and the Northern District. So in 1854, they met in conventions, decided that they were going to go ahead and do that. And then also, because of that, meet not as yearly, but then expanding out to being multi-years. After they started doing that, more and more congregations, more and more pastors, more and more teachers. We asked for help from outside of the country. William Lea asked for pastors from in Germany to come over. We also had different missionary societies in Steden, Germany, that had sent over missionaries to go ahead and help out, fill out, because we didn't have enough pastors. Even though we had the seminaries, we didn't have enough pastors to fulfill all the pulpits that were being opened up. So they decided then in 1878 to go ahead and expand even further and to go ahead. That was the very first year that they had a delegate synod. You might have heard Dr. Harmelink mention this before. We always reference the regular synods. But there was the first delegate synod, and it is tracked as well, because that was the first year that they started having more people from congregations that were able to come. So at that point, then, those four districts, some started splitting up and making smaller districts, Northwest District, Illinois District, Iowa District. So you can start to see how it's a narrowing down. More churches in an area, you need to have more representation, more visitation, so forth. So that's when they started doing that at that point. And then as we progress through to today, we have some states that have multiple districts within a state boundary.
Sure.
Some districts that aren't by state boundary. It's non-geographic.
Mm-hmm.
We had some districts that were started that are no longer in the country. The Brazil District, where we had missionaries who went to Brazil to help them. That then branched off from Brazil to Argentina and so forth. So, I mean, the Synod has expanded quite a bit by God's grace to go out to all the ends of the earth, as Christ told us we should be doing.
And this is then how we see not only a structure of districts, but also, I'm sure, as conventions, as we continue to meet in convention, then also church policy or polity, mm-hmm. and structure of synod, what it means to
Correct.
Be synod as we continue to learn what that means to be a Lutheran synod in North America.
Yes, our handbook is much different than it was when the first synod meeting took place. Yes.
And good point that about the how some districts started getting dividing, like in some states divided up into multiple districts. Some
right.
remained one district. And for example, in Illinois, we have Northern Illinois, Central Illinois, and Southern Illinois
Correct.
Districts. In Texas, we have one district.
Correct.
But they, within that district, have delegated or divided up some responsibilities
yes.
into regions.
Yes, correct. And as we have done ourselves within the synod, where we went ahead and moved from having different representation by vice presidents, we went to the regional aspect, which we do have now. That's fairly new.
Mm-hmm. So the structure and polity can change over time as well to meet the current
correct.
Needs. So we expanded from the 1800s to today. A lot has happened in that time.
Correct.
And now we're getting ready for the 66th convention, I believe this is.
Yes, this is going to be the 66th. Correct. And next year, which is slightly foreshadowed by the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, but we will be celebrating our 170th anniversary as a synod to be able to go ahead and say, see this expansion that mm-hmm. continues to take place. Again, all by God's grace, his word goes out and does what it has been sent to do.
Indeed. Amen. Now, you mentioned earlier that, as the synod continued to expand, there was a need for pastors because mm-hmm. new congregations were forming. How did they meet the need for those pastors? I think you mentioned briefly there was a call for more pastors,
mm-hmm,
request for that. How do you meet the need for such a rapidly growing church body?
Well, in some cases, those churches were not filled on an everyday basis. There was not an office where the pastor mm-hmm. was there and located. In many cases, they were traveling pastors who would go to a place and then go ahead and preach on Sunday, distribute communion, and then go to another place and so forth. Until they had enough funding where they could go ahead and call a pastor to that place. Many times you had that kind of a situation occur where a pastor might visit two or three different congregations, albeit we have that same situation today where there are some pastors mm-hmm. whose call is to two or three different congregations.
But today, transportation is a little bit different.
Yes.
So a pastor might lead divine service at his congregation here, hop in the car, drive 40 minutes to another congregation,
sure.
Down the road and a little bit of a ways down the road,
sure.
Preach and lead divine service there, maybe
right.
Bible class there as well. And he visits within those two parishes,
sure.
that dual parish throughout the week as well.
Those
at that
days,
time,
horse, boat, mule, some cases walking. It was not like, as you described for today, it was a long time between when they would come. But they set up a regular schedule where they would go ahead mm-hmm. and let the people know when they would be coming so that people would be able to say, we're going to go ahead and get together. Sometimes people would decide that they wanted to do this rather quickly and go ahead and say, we've got funding. Let's put up a building. Let's go ahead and call a pastor. We can provide for mm-hmm. this and so forth. Sometimes, the pastors weren't paid in monetary fees. Sometimes they were given things like you get so many chickens
sure.
or you're given so much other things. Yeah.
Well,
a little different.
I imagine walking from, from parish to parish, that was kind of the prototype for our wellness plan through Concordia Plans, right?
Sure. Yeah, right. Although in their case, it was for livelihood. In our case, it's to make sure that we stay alive.
Right. So,
yeah.
It was the early version of our wellness plan.
Yeah.
Pastor, you get to walk from this parish to this parish.
Right.
Man, that could be quite a journey in some cases.
Oh, yes. And we have records at Concordia Historical Institute that do talk about how the hardships are mm-hmm. for sometimes the pastors and what they have to do, the families of what they have to do in order to go ahead and live this kind of an existence. But you don't usually read about the pastor saying, oh, I'm going to give up on this place. I'm done with this place. It's usually, how can we continue to keep mm-hmm. on serving these people? How can we go ahead and make sure that God's word is being preached to these people, whether it's by him or whether it's by finding some other place? They would write back to the seminary. They would write to Walther and say, is there some way that we can get another pastor here? Remember, Walther at the time of the beginning of the synod was the president, and he was responsible for making sure that the pastors were all being taken care of.
So where were the pastors coming from that were being sent out to fill these new
vacancies?
Well,
in some cases, they were from the seminaries themselves, because we were training seminarians at the time, and we continued to keep on doing that between the two different seminaries. But we also had to request for individuals from out of the country as well. Hermannsburg provided some pastors from a missionary society, as I mentioned. Steedon, Pastor Bruin sent people over as well. So we were receiving people from outside missionary sources. A few years ago, we did have some German people who came over and wanted to go through all the people that we had who were pastors and that where they had come from, which mission society had sent them. They were trying to compile these lists. Things were lost over in Germany. They were not able to go ahead and do that, partly because of the number of wars that have taken place. So they were trying to go ahead and put these things together from our records to see if they could go ahead and do this. And they were surprised in some cases, people that they weren't sure if they actually had come from the society or not, and they were able to reconstruct things.
Now, at this point in history, where were the seminaries here in the United States that our pastors were coming from?
Well, the seminaries were here in St. Louis because in 1850, then it went ahead and moved from down in Perry County. It moved up here and was down on Jefferson Avenue for a good number of years until the current seminary was built, and then they moved in there in 1926. The Fort Wayne Seminary was started, and that has actually moved around a number of times. It was in Fort Wayne during the Civil War. It actually moved here to St. Louis, and they sent the college-bound kids there to Fort Wayne. Then they went ahead and moved to Springfield after they were in St. Louis, and then from Springfield they moved to Fort Wayne, where they currently are now.
So it was a senior college, I think, in Fort Wayne.
And there was a senior college in Fort Wayne before they actually moved the seminary there, correct.
Yeah. What a unique history. I could sit here and ask you history questions all day long.
Well, if you want to read more about the growth of the Synod and how it has taken off, the book Moving Frontiers, which Concordia Publishing House does have, has a chapter on it, Chapter 5, and it's talking about the early growth of the Missouri Synod. Another way that you can also go ahead and learn a little bit about that is by looking in the back of the Lutheran Annual. I know that Dr. Harmelink has talked about this before, that in the back of the Lutheran Annual, there are pages that talk about the statistics of the synod. It lays out when we've had our conventions, where they've been held, who've been the synod presidents, vice presidents, and so forth. So those two books would be very good for you to go ahead and take a look at in order to see.
Do we have today's business, which is like all the proceedings from, do we have today's business from the early conventions?
They didn't always do it in that way. Today's business is a little more current in terms of taking care of things, but they would know ahead of time what the kinds of topics were that were going to be brought up when they arrived at Synod. And remember, the congregations would go ahead and say, here's something we want to have addressed. And so they would send that in, and then that's what would be discussed at the synodical conventions.
But do we have any documents from those early synodical conventions?
That I've never actually looked. I mean, we have things from each one of the conventions. We have the proceedings and the workbooks from every single convention from the very beginning all the way up to the present. But I don't know how extensive they are in the sense of, you know, something like today's business and so forth.
Yeah.
I'm sure that we do have them. I've just not actually looked at them myself.
I can't imagine that, you know, doing all of that via snail mail compared to today.
Sure.
How much we use electronic communication to prepare for that. And I've seen just how busy it's been here at the International Center with so many people preparing for convention and people out around districts as well, preparing for that and all the work that goes into preparing for a convention. But I know electronic communication is a real key in helping us meet deadlines and make sure that everything's ready for that convention.
And some of that changes then our polity also, because with rapid communication, then we're starting to say, can some of these things be done on an outside basis ahead of time to try and formulate something so that we do come together in convention? We don't spend as much time debating an issue like over days. We spend fewer time going through that. So that helps us as well.
Has the convention itself gotten shorter in terms of time?
Not necessarily. Each convention ends up being between 4 and 5 days worth of time in order to take care of all the, again, partly because we meet on a 3-year basis at this point. And also, you know, we do have district conventions that take place where some of the things can be dealt with within the district before those things get sent on to the national convention.
Well, this is very insightful. What was the name of the book again?
The book is Moving Frontiers. It's by Carl Meyer. He was the editor. He was a professor at Concordia Seminary, a history professor. And the chapter, again, is called Early Growth of the Missouri Synod. And actually, Carl Meyer wrote that one himself. So that would be one book for you to be able to look at.
And I have to ask, which way do you spell Meyer?
M-E-Y-E-R, yeah. I know, we have lots of ways of Meyers, like correct.
Five ways to spell Meyer around here. Well, great. So you can find that from Concordia Publishing House.
Yes.
And you said Chapter 5 really gives a lot of information
talks
on
about
the expansion.
Correct.
Expansion mm-hmm. of the Lutheran Church, what is known today as the Lutheran Church Missouri
Synod.
Correct.
At that time, it was not.
It was the the German Evangelical Lutheran
Correct.
Church of Missouri, Ohio, and other states.
Correct. And it stayed that way until we actually changed it in 1947.
See, I paid attention when I went through the museum. when I went through the Concordia Historical Institute Museum here at the International Center.
That's good.
I need to come over and visit the museum on the seminary campus, too.
Well, actually, the museum at the seminary, we are going to be changing. We just closed the Papua mm-hmm. New Guinea exhibit.
Right.
We're going to be taking pictures of all the things that were in the exhibit, and then we'll be taking it down, and then we'll be prepping one for next year for the 500th anniversary. We're going to be displaying many of our coins and medals.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be displaying many of our rare books that are going to be out. My understanding is that the seminary, who's going to be going through some renovation at that time, their library will bring over some of their rare books, so it'll be a consolidated exhibit.
Is there any piece in particular that you're really excited about in the new exhibit?
That I don't know yet. We haven't even talked about what things are going to go in there, so...
Well, thank you, Mark. It's always fun to catch up with you. Thanks for coming over. I know that Dr. Harmelink is on the road with the gavel, maybe even listening right now.
Let us hope so.
Hopefully he's listening. Mark, I always enjoy talking with you, hearing about what you do at Concordia Historical Institute. You always bring some great insights. One of these days, I'm just going to have to lock you in the studio and just quiz you on all kinds of great history
okay,
for about
well,
5 hours.
Okay, well, hopefully I can answer them.
you do a great job. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Mark.
Coming up in just a little bit, morning prayer. Hope you can join us for that. We'll gather together around God's word and pray back to him the very word that he has given us. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.